Hello and welcome to episode 112 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello, Matt. Here we are again, and it's an episode I've been looking forward to some time, if I'm honest.
Why have you been looking forward to it?
Well, because we have we've had some quite unusual episodes, haven't we? We've been in Watford, and we've been doing some. We did two episodes where we were together. We did the live podcast.
Oh yeah,
and we haven't really done very many in this kind of in our classic format. You know, you down there and me up here, and we did one last week where I was essentially. I was in such exquisite agony that I couldn't really contribute anything other than the occasional groan. So now I feel I'm back. You know, the mojo's back, and we're back doing what we do best. I think so. That's why I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. And this is the beginning of your second week of your new job. How's that going?
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of a culture shock being owned by an organisation, lock, stock, and barrel. But having said that, it was a really interesting first week, and I spent some time in London meeting people. I spent some time in Brussels meeting customers and people, and all kind of, you know, I think whenever you start a new job, no matter what sort of job it is, really, it's a bit like going into a dark room, and you know, everybody does their best to kind of show you know the around and understand the landscape, but really, it's like every day somebody will come and turn the lights on a little bit more. So you stop bumping into things and you start to see shapes and you start to discern them. And then the lights on a bit more and you realize that shape actually wasn't what you thought it was. But, you know, it all becomes slightly clearer over time, almost imperceptibly until you can see everything. And that's kind of where I am at the moment, trying to remember names and meeting people and doing all those things. But it's, fascinating first week and one day.
Very good. Kind of feels, I'm just trying to think, it's 8 years since I last went through that experience of actually starting a job. But
but we do that, don't we? When we're self-employed, when we kind of go into organizations and have to pick all that up quite quickly, don't we? So it's not as if you don't do that.
No, absolutely. I was just thinking that actually the rapid switching between organizations is kind of, you have to be able to get a handle on, you know, what the objects are and whether the lights are on or not much quicker than you would in the kind of traditional induction process. It would be interesting to see whether you feel it's quite slow in comparison, considering how many different organisations you've worked with over the last few years.
I do think it's a little bit like that, as much as when you're on a day rate, you're on a day rate because every day you are delivering a day's worth of value. Do you know what I mean? Now, that doesn't really change it shouldn't change when you're in a sort of full-time role, but your horizon is further out. You're trying to build something that's got a sustainable outcome to it. Whereas when you're doing day rate work, you kind of got your horizons are much shorter, aren't they? So you're probably more likely to knock things over and not really worry about it in order to get to the end state. You know, that would be how I would describe it. I would be more likely just to sort of get things, you know, it doesn't really matter if I knock a few things over and some china goes crashing, as long as I get to the end and I deliver what I'm meant to deliver. Whereas if you've got to live with the person whose china it is for an extended period, maybe you're a bit more careful. I don't know.
It's somewhat of a tortured analogy there, but the
I told you that's what we were going back to our usual
absolutely. But the other thing is that, of course, part of your work is continuing to do pretty much what you've been doing in terms of consulting for clients, but then you've got the learning of the organization that you're working for to do that, rather than when you're doing it on your own, where it's actually comparatively easy to most of the time, especially if you're working as a completely independent contractor. You know, the only part of the organization you need to understand from your home organization is yourself. And of course, you know, that can be a challenge on occasion, but you don't have to worry about working practice or method or any of the rest of it, because it's how you do stuff. And that's the biggest shift now, isn't it? That you're working as part of an organization that is, it has structure and it has process and it has systems and all the rest of it, which that's the bit you've been out of for a while.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, part of the part of the joy of this, in as much as one of the reasons that I was keen to do it, was that it's not the same as most of the rest of the organization. So it's a little bit to be created. So that's good. And also, everybody's been very welcoming and supportive. So that's also quite good. It's it can be a bit unnerving if you turn up to a place nobody wants to talk to you or actively wants you to fail, which sometimes does happen.
Yeah, I've known that. Anyway, so this week's show, we have got an interview coming up with Sophie Smallwood, who is co-founder of a company called Rollshare. We're going to be talking with her about what her business does and also some of the concepts that they are pushing forward around job sharing and the future of flexible working. And we see a welcome return, which is where we're going to start, to Internet Yin and Yang. So let's press on with that.
So as promised, here we go. We're going to bring back our semi-regular, and I think actually missing for some time, feature, beloved of all our regular listeners, which is the Internet Yin and Yang. And as is traditional, Matt, you've got the Internet Yin. What is this week, Matt?
Well, to be honest, this is probably a yang because it's brilliant, but is framing it as a yin because it's just, stereotypes and all that. And the ability for the internet to be able to allow what can only be described as factually challenged items of common folklore or utter bollocks, as it's otherwise known, to be able to be perpetuated. And, this has got some really dark sides. So, the ability for nonsense about vaccinations, which is now having a material impact on the world and that people are dying from measles, which well done, everybody, for that. Well done. But the common and promoted by all sorts of fitness trackers and health apps, the common idea that we should be doing 10,000 steps a day, and it's nonsense apparently. And it's nonsense because of something that I picked up on the internet this week. So this is the good bit. So a professor of epidemiology at Harvard University, T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Ai Min Lee, is the lead author of a new study published this week in the Journal of American Medical Association. She began looking into the 10,000 step rule because she was curious about where it came from. And it turns out that the original basis for this was a marketing strategy. And the marketing strategy in 1965, this is fabulous, a Japanese company who was selling pedometer, and they called it the 10,000 step meter. And this professor, from the discussions she's had, she believes the reason why the name 10,000 step meter was chosen is because the Japanese kanji character for 10,000 looks sort of like a person walking.
Okay.
And that's the origin of there's no validation in any way, shape or form that she can find about any sort of actual health stuff. But the 10,000 rule thing is a 50 whatever year old piece of mythology based around the fact that something looked like something else.
I think I thought you was going to say that it was the counter had four numbers on it, and then when you got to 9,999, it rolled around. I mean, that's as good a reason, is it? And I always thought, I got a Fitbit, and that I used to wear, but I always thought the 10,000 steps was a bit of an arbitrary number. I didn't think that there was meant to be any science behind it. But maybe, yeah. I can see where you're coming from. I have to say though, Matt, that who is this research by? I'm in Lee. It sounds like in Lancashire. That means something completely different. It means that that's where you are.
Yeah, it's a northern joke, isn't it? I'm not even going to go there. So anyway, there's the internet yin for the week. Now lift us up.
Well, I thought that given that we're back into this routine, I'm going to bring something scientifically puerile, I think I'll describe it as. It's something I found, something I came across on in my Twitter feed last week. And it's a spreadsheet that's been collated. And I think it's one of these crowdsourced. It is crowdsourced. And various people that have verified this information are listed on the spreadsheet. And actually, in fact, one of them is Chris Lintott, who is the Sky at Night presenter, although I suspect he is giving his own opinion here rather than a factual answer. So the spreadsheet is essentially a list of animals, and it's asking the question, does it fart? So, for example, you have bobcats, which apparently do. Cockroaches, yes. Okay, so the cockroaches do. Domestic cats, yes. What should we do? What else?
There's one that's particularly timely for my one is parakeets.
Oh, of course, yes, because you had a parakeet fatality, didn't you?
Got back from holiday last weekend, found a dead parakeet on the roof and left it for the day, and then it's gone. But yeah, apparently parakeets are a maybe, although looking through the list there, it says that actually that might be counterfactual because of the fact that it is also said that birds can't generally fart.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's quite a few along the snakes line, and the one that says here says snakes, ball python. Does it fart? No. Description: we have not heard any audible sounds from the vent in 5+ years of care. There you go. So somebody's taken some time over this.
It does look like mostly the answer is it a mammal? Yes, then yes. And is it not? Maybe. So mollusks don't fart, apparently.
That's true. Unicorns are on there. And Chris Lintott, the Sky at Night gadgy, he put an answer for aliens. But his answer was maybe. So, you know, hedging his bets. Oh, Chris.
Oh, so there we go. The internet is able to disseminate all sorts of information, some of it nonsense and the rest of it nonsense. So,
I'll tell you as well, Chris Lintott, if you've ever seen him, I mean, over time has wearied us both, but once upon a time when we were both younger, he and I, well, he looked a lot like me, Chris Lintott, and I always used to think that he was the me that studied harder at school and, you know, got into doing presenting TV programs about space, whereas I was sitting at a desk programming a computer. So I always look at Chris and he's my kind of alter ego, successful brother.
That's quite sad. there we go. Anyway, it's good to have Internet Union back. I think it's probably the least serious one we've ever done, but you know, fair play for that. And more in a couple of weeks' time than that.
So we have an interview tonight, Matt. As we have trailed, we've got Sophie Smallwood of Rollshare. And you were talking to her about what she does and how she does it.
Yes. Interesting startup. And so I asked her about that. And I also asked her about the experience of moving from big tech companies that she worked for in the past to where she is now going into tiny, tiny startup. But anyway, I started off by asking Sophie about what role sharing is all about.
We call it role sharing, but it's probably better known as job sharing. But the way we look at the future is we think jobs will change. Jobs probably won't be what they are today, but the role that you play in an organization will probably be more of what you're focused on. So we decided to go with the idea of role sharing. But ultimately, it's the idea of a micro team. So if you look at today's roles or jobs, it's how can you dissect that into a micro team and having two people share the responsibilities of a role while at the same time being able to have more flexibility in their lives to pursue other passions, be it responsibilities towards family members and or passion projects, in essence, gaining a bit more time in their lives without having to sacrifice a career that they have worked hard for, right? So that's one of the challenges today when you want flexibility in your career. You, in essence, have to sacrifice your growth, your trajectory, the impact that you've already built up in exchange for flexibility. Well, we believe that that shouldn't necessarily have to happen, that if you share a role with someone, you can continue to pursue a career path that you've set forward, but at the same time, gain some time back. And it's also a win-win for companies because they get the full-time coverage that they need for that role. So that's the high-level descriptor of role share, I would say.
Okay. And that's different from, say, a job where you have people working on shift patterns. You've got this concept of the micro team, and that's different from, say, I don't know, bar work, where you will have three people who work the bar at different times, but they're not really a micro team because there's no real crossover. They do the same job, but at different times.
Exactly.
What you're talking about, it's subtly different, yeah?
Absolutely. So the way we think about it is it's enabling people to have more flexibility in the white collar space, typically industries and or careers where it's been difficult to get flexibility, where there needs to be full-time coverage for a role because of the demands and the seniority of the role, and where there needs to be a very refined transition between one person to another, because there has to be continuity in the role. And also it's a way to gain more skills for a particular role. So today when someone is looking to hire for a role, they typically find one candidate that best matches the specifications of the job post. In this instance, we want to try and complement people's skills by having two individuals in a role, helping them leverage each other's strengths and also learn from each other. So it's also in line with, if you think about the future of work, when it comes to a sustainable workforce. So some people might have heard of the 100-year life, the book. You know, people are living longer, people are already having to work more, and it's going to continue. And can you continue to work in the same capacity if your career is going to be an 80-year career? It's perhaps not realistic for some, maybe, but it might be that we have to think about how do you work less hours per week for a longer period of time, and while still growing in a career and feeling fulfilled, and having an opportunity to have a long burn, a pleasant long burn of a career as opposed to short term sort of burnout.
So what was it that brought you to the point of thinking you needed to set up a platform to be able to help people do this?
So it was a personal need initially. I have worked in tech for probably half of my career now, and I was with eBay and most recently with Facebook, and been very, very career driven my entire life. It's a big part of my identity, my career persona, and a big part of my self-confidence as well. And when I was pregnant with my first child, well, I only have one child, but when I was pregnant with Leo, I started to think about how am I going to make it all work? How am I going to continue to honor my career trajectory and my personal career ambitions at the same time, be present and be the best that I can be, you know, as a family member and as a parent? And I started to think about a story that I'd heard about 8 years ago or so in Los Angeles. At the time, you know, it was very free. My career was everything to me. And I met a woman who was equally ambitious. She was more senior than I was. She worked at a big, big global advertising agency. And she mentioned that she also had twins. And I remember, and her and I volunteered together once a week. And I thought, how are you doing this? How are you managing this incredibly demanding career in advertising with twins and also volunteering? And she mentioned to me that she was very lucky because she shared a role. And it's something that always stuck in my mind. And when I was pregnant, I thought that would be such a great deal for me to be able to have a cool career while still having a few days where I can completely disconnect, no guilt, and really focus on this other part of my life, which is my caregiving responsibility. And so I was speaking with Dave, my husband, about it. And I mentioned to him, you know, some of my concerns about what having a child might mean to my career and my desire to be present in both. And I said, wouldn't it be great? I wish that there was a place where I could find someone to share a role with based on our skills and our background and our experience, because I have no idea where to start today. I know that there are some people, recruiters, who help with this on a one-on-one basis. But, you know, because of my tech background, I work with Magento, which is an e-commerce platform, and under eBay. And then, you know, at the time I was working with Workplace by Facebook, which is an enterprise communications platform. So I very much think about solving things through platforms. And I like the idea of having choice and being able to choose, in essence, the people that I'd want to share a role with myself based on some commonalities. And at the time, Dave was at London Business School and he was starting his executive MBA program. And one of the courses was a new ventures course. And he loved the concept. And he said, let's do this. I would love to make this the project that I pitch for the new ventures course. And so he built a 1-minute video and presented it in the course. 60 other ideas were presented as well. And this was one of the 60 ideas. So 10 ideas were selected to be worked on that first during that new ventures course. And at the end of the semester, the ideas presented their findings. Ultimately, it was to identify whether or not this was a viable business idea. And Dave and his team got third best presentation overall, but it was the only viable idea in the top three. And what we were most excited about was that this was the crowd favorite. So of all the ideas that were presented, the role share idea was the crowd favorite. So that's a bit of background of how it started. And then we had a baby around that time. Dave, at the time, was with PayPal, got promoted. And so it was very demanding. Things sort of dragged along a little bit. And then in November of this year, I'd been back at work at Facebook for about 9 months. And I decided I really want to make impact. I want to have a project that's my own. I want to really drive strategy. And RoleShare has always been at the back of my mind. You know, I want to work on this. I want to make it happen. And so I just decided that it was time. Someone needed to quit and really focus on this project 100%. And so I decided to make that move.
So the platform that you've developed is about being able to match people who both want to be able to share jobs to enable them to be able to help employers to be able to, you know, cut through some of the, well, there's nobody for you to share your job with.
Yeah.
Part of it. Is that right?
So it's a marketplace, right? So you have two sides of the marketplace. You have the individuals who want to share a role and then helping them find people to share a role with. And then there's people who perhaps just want to find someone to share a role with, but don't have a role that they could share. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then there's companies that are forward-thinking companies who see this as an opportunity to, in essence, live and breathe their missions of diversity and inclusion and, you know, creative ways of working. There's more and more sort of new age thinking companies that I've seen actually when they post jobs actively, proactively say, hey, if you're looking to apply for this role, but are interested in flexible work and or job sharing, let's talk. So those are the types of companies that we would want to work with and have them list out some of their roles. So it's a two-sided marketplace.
And obviously there's that part about being able to match people who want to be able to do this. I guess then there's also two sets of mindset shifts that need to happen for job sharing, role sharing to become successful. The first is, what do employees need to do differently to enable that to happen? And then also, what do employers need to do differently to enable that to happen? Can we unpack those a bit? So starting with employees, from what you've seen so far and from your own experience, what are the sorts of things that we individually need to think about differently to be able to make a role share work?
So this has been a lot of what I've been researching as part of our qualitative interviews. And actually, it's really not that different than any other functioning team today, right? So it all comes down to how the role is split. So the individual sharing a role could be literally sharing the role like for like, where one person is working Monday through Wednesday. When the other person comes into the office, they do the exact same role. They pick up exactly where the other person left off. And the motto oftentimes with these individuals is seamless from the outside. This is something that I've heard a few times. And so there's I think the only really key consideration here is there has to be a real onus and responsibility in making sure that there is a good transition, a good tracking of communication between the partners, which actually, interestingly, I think makes them better in their jobs as individuals because they're recording things that perhaps they wouldn't have been doing if they were doing the job just on their own, right? So there's a greater record keeping, a greater onus of responsibility for each person to make sure that the transition goes well. So that might be one thing that is different versus someone doing the role on their own. Now, in other instances, I've seen individuals share the role different ways. So one person might be more front of house because he or she is more comfortable being the client-facing individual, and the other person is perhaps more analytical, more research, more planning focus. And so they split their responsibilities in that way. So the transitions will be a bit different, but they can, of course, stand in for each other on things that need to be done when the other individual is not in the office. So it just really depends on how the work is split. Now, I think from the greater team perspective, how things work differently, it has to do mostly with them understanding who is doing what and when they are doing it. But again, that from what I understand on the interviews I've done, if the communication is clear, so for example, there's an out-of-office notice that says, you know, XYZ works on this day and, you know, the other person works on these other days. It's just about making sure that everyone is clear and also customers are clear on who their primary points of contact are on which days and also for which areas of communication. Similarly to any team, really, you know, today in the past when I've done enterprise customer success, my customers knew what my area of business was and what I covered. And they also knew what some of my cross-functional partners were doing, and they knew who to contact for what. So ultimately, it just comes down to having super communication and clarity. Your question about employers. So from an employer perspective, and this is part of my research right now, because we're still developing the product, is really trying to understand, you know, what does it mean? What are the additional criteria to set up a micro team? I think it comes down to, you know, some of the typical HR onboarding, which nothing really changes other than the fact that most companies today operate in a headcount capacity. So in a case like a micro team, you have two heads doing a single role. So from an operational perspective, that sometimes can create some questions. But recruiters and HR directors I've spoken with actually have said that when they have implemented job sharing, that's not been really a concern. It's just a matter of you know, being flexible in how you think of headcounts. And then something that you had mentioned a while back was this idea of the span of control from a manager perspective. And perhaps you can touch on that because you know it better than I do. But yeah, basically right now we're just trying to really learn about what some of the limitations and considerations are from an employer perspective. But what I'm really most interested in understanding is that, you know, what is the productivity gain? Because qualitatively speaking, every single person I've spoken to, both people who have shared a role where they've had a successful job share and managers who have managed individuals who've shared a role, they all say qualitatively that the people who share a role are more productive. There's a significant productivity gain, which makes sense because in essence, they're working 6 days, you know, the equivalent to 6 days. And of course, it's costing the company 6 days versus a 5-day salary, but they can take on more work. There's more coverage when one person's out of the office, the other person can cover and keep the role moving. There's also sort of an embedded training mechanism. They can train each other on like utility skills that are needed for the organization. And there's also sort of like a natural coaching phenomenon that happens between the two individuals. And there really is the sense that they're in it together because they are measured together for the role. And whereas today, you know, on a team, like a sales team, for example, yes, you're part of a core team, but every single salesperson on the team is direct competition with each other. Whereas in a shared role capacity, you're in it together because you're measured together as a team and it's meant to be seamless.
And that, I think, is an interesting cultural challenge for a lot of organizations where the cult of individualism has become kind of all encompassing. The number of organizations that I work with where they describe people as being either managers or individual contributors, and that the way in which people are rewarded, that the performance management is assessed, all the rest is all done on the basis of individual accountability rather than team accountability. And I personally think that's crackers anyway, because then the same organisations would be saying, but we seem to have problems getting our people to work together. Instead of, yeah, go figure. But there's, if you've got this concept of micro teams, these two people teams who are actually properly sharing a role, at that point, you really have got to think about how at least half of what they do is assessed on the basis of what they are doing collectively, if not all of it. And that actually flies in the face of, 20 years or so of performance management culture.
Right. And I think, naturally some people are just better team players anyway, right? And when I think about sharing a role, I don't think it's, based on my research, I've identified a number of traits that seem to be common across successful teams, micro teams. And it's not for everyone, right? So someone who is extremely competitive, someone who likes to press forward and not have anyone come in their way. There's different types of personalities out there that are great performers inside of companies, but actually might not be a very good fit for a micro team. And probably this individual would never even seek this type of working arrangement anyway. But in order to do a role share successfully, there are certain traits and characteristics, regardless of the type of role, that you need to have in order to be a good micro team player.
So thinking a little broader now, I'm interested in your experience of transitioning from working for big, successful tech companies and going into the world of startup, which is something that you've done over the last year or so, I guess.
Yeah.
And how you found that and what you've had to adapt, not only now doing a role share, but also now having to deal with a micro company, let alone a micro team. How have you found that transition?
So it's fun. It's really fun. And I think I'm the type of person that typically takes calculated risks. I've worked for myself once before when I was in Los Angeles, and I was doing something completely different. And I was a real estate broker. And I don't know if you know anything about the real estate industry in the US, but it's typically 100% commission. So it's a lot of upfront costs, because you're paying rent and you're doing your own marketing, you're basically killing what you eat. And that has its rewards as well, because when you do get a client, it's extremely euphoric and exciting, and you feel great. But it's a dog-eat-dog world, and you just never know when you're going to get paid again. And I remember doing that for about a year and a half or so. And it was probably the time of my life where I was the most stressed, because I never knew when I was going to get paid next. Like, and I remember at the end, I'm like, okay, I'm done. Like, I cannot do this anymore. And I didn't know if I would ever want to work for myself again. And if I did, I would do it differently. And so then I went back into the marketing and advertising world, then moved over to eBay and then Facebook. And I think what I learned was that it's really important to have the right kind of team, regardless of where you are, whether it's a big company or a small company, a startup. The team and the people around you is the most important thing. I would never do a startup on my own. I need the team spirit. I need the positivity. I need the camaraderie. Just like I would never work all alone, be an individual contributor without a greater core team at a large company. So I think the team aspect for me, regardless of the size of the company, is really what makes or breaks the experience. And then from a large company perspective, I mean, let's be real, it's much easier working for a big company. If you perform well, you have the cushiness of knowing when your paycheck is coming. There's less responsibility. It's not necessarily your baby. There's not as much as at stake. So there's less pressure. I think all of these things are obviously present in a startup, right? It's your responsibility. It's everything that you're putting out on the line. It's your idea. So there's a lot more emotional, at stake. There's just a lot more emotionally at stake. But from a large company perspective, there's also this idea of, being more refined. So where I've enjoyed my roles in large companies has been when I've been able to be more of a generalist, where I could touch different parts of the business, really help influence strategy in different areas. So both from product to marketing to, you know, sales and enterprise customer success. I've enjoyed having my hands in everything. And I found that as companies get bigger and the teams that you're a part of become bigger and bigger, your role becomes much more refined. And that's when I start to get a little bit less interested. So I think where startups are incredible is that, you know, you have to roll up your sleeves and you've got to do a bit of everything. You get to touch the high level strategy and you have direct influence on the product and you are learning an incredible vast array of things. Like I'm working very closely with our backend engineer who's focused on our algorithm, and never in my life would I have had that opportunity, you know, Facebook or eBay, to work so closely with someone like that, to think about the intelligence behind the algorithm of, you know, of a product. So those types of things are incredibly, I think, rewarding from a startup perspective. And, but yeah, you don't have the safety net of a large company. But as I said, I approach things in a calculated perspective. Typically, I take calculated risks. So the way we approach this is that I am part of a micro team myself. My husband works full time today, and he allocates time on the weekends and the evenings to work on RollShare. And so he is our safety net while I'm focusing on this full time. And the other members of my team are also together sharing roles, but they have their full time jobs as well. So we're progressing, perhaps not as fast as we would progress if we were all on this full time, but we believe this is a marathon. And so this is the strategy that we've taken. And we also want to make sure that we are eating our own dog food. So we wanted to experience micro teams ourselves.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think the thing, there's a lot of mythology around startup that it's young people who are able to eat out of, you know, tins of beans and be able to sustain themselves while they're working 40-hour days and then you've got idiots like Elon Musk who perpetuate this bullshit as well. The reality is most startups are founded by people who are aren't young.
Yeah.
You know, certainly not, you know, sub 30.
What are you saying, Matt?
Yeah, okay. There's a hole here I'm digging, isn't it? Most people are about my sort of age, and then there are some that are younger like you. Does that help? I don't know. But if you've got responsibilities, if you've got kids, if you've got a mortgage, if you've got the rest of those kind of things that sit around being somebody who isn't in their 20s living out of cans of beans.
Yeah.
You have to do it at a slower pace.
Yeah.
Got to a stage now where you're looking at have got investment from outside? Because that changes the equation a bit as well, doesn't it? When then the focus goes from just building your users to building your users and satisfying your investors.
So at the moment, we've consciously decided not to go after funding for the time being. We want to continue to have freedom. We know that at the moment we're not looking to go after funding because we want to be really focused on the product and we want to be able to deliver on the vision of the first phase that we have. And our knowledge is that to go after funding and to raise money is almost like a full-time job. So we've made the conscious decision that we'd rather focus our time right now on building the product, running experiments, learning. And then once we're in a position to actually have data to back up what we're doing, then we'll be in a better position to get funding, to get the type of funding that we do want to get, and also be able to focus more of our time to do that. I don't want to go for funding right now at the cost of the quality of our first phase product, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I think once you get to that point, then the equations definitely change because you're having to satisfy two very different customers, effectively, the speculative finance customer and the customer of whatever it is that the service you're delivering.
But we will, right? We will have to. And just to touch on your point about age, and I think this is a good point, and it's really worth it. There's a couple things. You mentioned, I mentioned the marathon, and then we kind of agree on that point, but I read the book Originals, which I love. I think it's a great book. There's some great bits in there about being an original thinker and people who are startup founders, etc. And there's different ways of approaching a startup, right? There's the sprint mindset and there's the marathon runner. We're definitely the marathon runners. And one thing I liked in the book is that they said typically marathon runners are also much more adaptable and flexible because you're not super attached to the way you were initially thinking about approaching the startup. And it's all about being agile, which we are being. And this is all part of the experiments that we're looking to run once we launch our phase one product. But the other thing that they mentioned is that, you know, there's older founders bring a wealth of experience with them. So I'm 39 years old. I have incredible experience. Our team is diverse in age. Like we have individuals that are significantly younger than us and a few that are older as well. But, you know, the wealth of experience that experience brings to a startup is hugely valuable, right? So I think this is why we're approaching things the way we are. It's because of the experience we've had in the large corporate sector. And, you know, I think what I'm really excited about is that we're setting up a strong foundation. We've spent a lot of time thinking about our business plan, about our product marketing plan. We've spent a lot of time building out content so that we're ready to release that content in line with the product, the phase one product. So I think experience, you know, has a ton of value. And for me, age is irrelevant when we think about the fact that I could very well live to be over 100 and, you know, 100 years old. So I'm 39, which means I'm practically a baby.
Well, that was an excellent interview, Matt. I think we can both identify with the not knowing when you're going to get paid next part of that.
Yes. Some of us more than others. yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I met up with Sophie a few months ago, the interview we did actually about a month or so ago. And I think that there's a whole bunch of things about how the concepts, I really like the idea of thinking about role sharing as micro teams rather than as job sharing. Because I think that that helps to be able to give some context. It doesn't make it necessarily any easier, but I think it gives it a bit more context about how you need to think of how people would work together to deliver outcomes as a micro team in a way that is about, you know, deeply collaborative working. But there's a whole bunch of factors that make that really hard. And I think probably, you know, the thing above all else is the incredibly individualistic performance management cultures that most organizations have. You're assessed on the basis of your performance, not your team's performance. And if you've got two people working in a micro team, the, you know, just the whole performance management processes around that. And, you know, there's a broad debate about whether performance management as we know it is a load of bunk anyway. I'm probably subscribed to that view. But how much there is around corporate expectation, corporate culture, corporate processes, ways of working, financial models, the whole lot that gets really thrown in the air with the idea of two people working together to deliver a role in tandem. And stuff I've written about in the last few months about, you know, things like Microsoft Office and on 365, its inability to cope with the idea that an individual might do work on behalf of somebody else. And if you look at things like Microsoft Teams and what that does to things like private offices within the civil service and within the government, where you have often more than one, what would be called an executive assistant in other organizations, working on behalf of a principal of their boss, and doing it under their name. And that all gets thrown apart or blown apart by what happens within the new world of software, which assumes that everybody does their own work. And where does a micro team sit within that? A whole bunch of real complexity where not only the way that organizational culture works, but then also the systems and tools that we use within organizations are based on the principle that it's one person working in a job and doing that job mostly in an office.
That's very true. So you're looking for Microsoft Teams to introduce the factotum feature.
Yes. And it's not going to happen because it's so countercultural to the way in which software organizations work. That's just not how they do stuff.
I think also the there is a, when you try to share a role, and let's face it, we've all worked in teams, and I'm sure you've worked in companies where bonuses and things have been paid on partly on team performance and partly on individual performance, because people want everybody, you know, people want to encourage a team outcome. But there's a lot of overhead in teamwork in terms of communication. And when you are, especially when you're in a leadership role, if you have to share those visions and, well, not just vision in a kind of long-term strategic way, which you can do because that you should be doing that anyway, but when that's broken down to more granular level and you're having to sort of break down and justify every decision and everything you do to somebody who is your peer in that role, I think that adds quite a lot of overhead. And I think it's quite difficult. I think it's quite difficult on a human level. Not everybody is able to share why they do things. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And does that, would it improve our efficiency if we were made to do that? Well, maybe, I don't know, but I think it was a real culture change.
Yeah, I wonder whether that's a UK culture thing as well, or not exclusive to the UK, but you know, we do have this, you know, sole leader, single person in power, Churchill nonsense to get churned up again and again and again, the fact that we are useless at the idea of shared power culture in the UK. You know, we don't have a history of coalition government, and you know, the last decade has shown that we're really quite rubbish at it because we don't operate in that mindset, which is not the case across many other countries in Europe because they are used to that. And so because they're used to it, it has enabled them to be able to develop approaches and culture and behaviours that enable it to happen. And I wonder whether actually there's something there about UK culture that expects the lone leader. And you know, why is leadership expected to be a singular activity? I think that's a cultural challenge that is actually really problematic for UK culture at the moment. You know, as we are looking at what's going on in politics at the moment, you go, oh God, would it be better or worse with more than one of them? But I don't know. I think that there's, you know, again, something that I can't remember if I talked about it in the interview or not with Sophie, but I've certainly had conversations with her about the concept of peer programming. And peer programming, I have seen used and have seen it demonstrably better, because two minds on something are better than one, and it gives a process and a structure for being able to do that. I've also heard recently the concept of mob programming, where you have even more people involved. But the challenge within those kind of models primarily is, an accountant will look at it and go, you're having two people to do the job of one, are you mad? And that will kill it dead, because it doesn't look like it's going to be more efficient, because there's no evidence to show that up front. Therefore, it never is even experimented with.
Yeah, and although I think probably if you asked 100 software developers whether pair programming was a successful way of doing things, they would say yes. The evidence is that that's the case. Then you ask them if they would like to do it. They say no, because it's very uncomfortable. It's, you know, it's uncomfortable not to be, you know, well, again, maybe it's the culture of how we're taught to code, but maybe not. You know, my experience, and you know, I'm not much of a coder anymore. But when I think back to being a coder and when, you know, spending most of your time coding, there's so much going on in your head. There's so much being maintained in your brain. That's why I can't do it anymore, because my brain is significantly smaller than it was when I was younger. But there's so much being maintained in terms of program state, in terms of variables and structures and all of that kind of thing. So you are playing these things through, and you are iterating this stuff through in your brain, and you are working on a bit of code. There's no mechanism to share that other than maybe talking about it and hoping that the person next to you has got the same thing going on in their brain. Now, I think in pair programming, it doesn't matter that it's not the same thing, but because both people are sensitive looking at the same code, the same structures, and it doesn't matter how they think, the fact that they're both probably thinking about it in a different way is probably good, but it just feels difficult. It feels impossible because it's so personal. I think as I said before, there's a lot of human frailties, or human, as you say, cultural things that get in the way of this.
You'd also have to be able to have people who got on with one another. And that makes a heck of a difference. And I mean, today I spent some time with somebody I'm working with at the moment, Simon White, who I've known for years, and we've done little bits of work together. We had him on the show actually a year or so ago. And we're doing an innovation session for a client, and we spent about 2 hours, and we had a table and some cards, and we were bouncing ideas off each other, and we got the thing done to plan out 3 days of workshops and some quite complex stuff within it, and we got it done in 2 hours. And actually, I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, I've been kind of working through recently, is actually the way I work at the moment can be remarkably lonely. And days like this is, you know, the sorts of days when I'm going, actually, no, this I can, as long as I get that balance of being going to work with people and work with people that I know a bit and trust and you can fire off. But that then becomes the other issue, doesn't it? Because if you think about recruitment and the way in which people are recruited and the roles that are recruited for, lots of roles are recruited on the basis of them effectively, and the bigger the organisation is, obviously, the more the case, effectively those roles are human commodity, and the personalities of the people involved actually is often mitigated against these days through, you know, best practice in recruitment, which would say, oh, you can't recruit somebody just because you like them. Heaven forbid, you need to be able to know their competencies. And that, you know, if you think about how you would recruit, this is why the role share thing I think is interesting, because if you're going to bring two people together to work in a micro team, my God, they're going to have to get on well.
They are. And that trust thing is going to be important as well, because, of course, what else happens in organizations is you get promotion, you get change. People are, you know, it can be quite a competitive world. And what happens when your partner in your role, they end up, well, who's going to do this particular piece of work? Oh, no, I'll do that. But maybe that's the bit of work that gets some recognition in the company. And why did that person do that work? They knew that we're going to get that recognition. And that's not fair. And no, I'm not, next time I'm not. That can easily become a really kind of weird dynamic, because guess who gets promoted? It's not that you can't get promoted together. Oh, you both come and do this job now. That's probably not going to happen.
Well, you could. But
it's not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily going to follow. It's, yeah, I think because it's unusual and because we're not used to using those, you know, working those ways, I think it's tough. I think it's laudable, you know, and I hope it goes, it works out for Sophie and Rollshare, because I think there's a lot to be gained from it. But yeah, some tricky terrain to cross, I think.
So we wend our way merrily towards the end of another show. What does the week ahead hold in store for Mr. Weston?
Well, if you ask me this question, Matt, every week from now on, it'll be the same answer, because I'm doing the same thing, which is doing my job. But and on the worst of that, just more figuring out, you know, the landscape of where I am. But I've got no exotic travel planned, so it'll be just a lot of meetings and cracking on with stuff. How about yourself?
I've got some work kicking off with one client. We've got coming towards the end of the podcast power projects work with central government department. More planning for this innovation event. I've got another innovation event that people. I need to get a proposal together for. It's all this stuff that you used to do, but now you're just lounging around in your so-called job.
You take that back.
But no, it's good. There's things seem to be picking up a bit now. I think that the focus around innovation seems to be one that actually now I've got a framework to work within. Seems to be, I think, a good mine to be dug.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole point about innovation is when we do, you know, what we've talked about it so many times, haven't we, on this podcast, and probably before we started this podcast, is the fact that it is difficult to do. It's easy to spend a lot of time and effort and money on it, but doing it well and understanding the innovation is actually, it's there if you look for it in the right places, but being able to sort of nurture it and fertilize it and make it into something that's sustainable is that's the tricky part. And finding people that can help you do that is a real trick.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's the one that I'm going to be playing. So there we go. Good. Well, have a good week, and look forward to seeing you again. If you want to find out more about stuff on the show, you can find details at wb40podcast.com. We have a whole of the back catalogue there. Wouldn't go beyond about episode 24 before that.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us, as always, on wb40podcast.com. You can speak to us on Twitter at wb40podcast. And you can hear us on all of the usual podcast platforms, being Stitcher, Acast, iTunes, Google Podcasts, etc. And if you do that, and there's a chance to leave us a review, please do it, because we love to get the feedback.